court will now call Al Sides, Larry Naga versus the state. And may it please the court, Mr. Richard Henderson to argue for the appellant, Mr. Stephen Condor to argue for the state.
Mr. Henderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Richard Henderson. I represent Al Sides, Larry Naga. I also represented him at the trial level on this murder case. And thanks to Texas A&M Law School for inviting us down here. I'm not used to being quite this close to you in the courtroom. To help explain this situation, perhaps a little bit of brief background would help the younger audience here. In 1980, between April and October, in an agreement between Fidel Castro and then Jimmy Carter, some 125,000 Cuban immigrants came to the United States. Many of them were legitimate immigrants, but also Castro opened his prisons and mental hospitals, and it wasn't until October that Jimmy Carter figured it out and said, we got to call a halt to this. A crime wave hit many cities across the United States, some really violent ones in New York, and some ended up in Fort Worth. I have represented many of them over the years, but they're graying, as am I. Al Sides Larrañaga was one of the Marielitos. There is a Cuban community now on the east side of Fort Worth where the incident subject to this case took place. It was the home of Mamacita, known as Annie Sneed, and Uncle Papacito Uvaldo Negret. Uvaldo Negret was the biological uncle of Al Sides Larrañaga. It's very interesting that almost everyone who testified in the trial was a Marielito and also had a criminal record, including murder and drug charges. On this particular Sunday in May, many people were out and about gathering at Mama Sita's house. She must have been a really great cook. The defendant lived in a rundown travel trailer behind the house. The deceased, Joel Gill, known as Cuban Joe, and his son Jermaine were there, along with many other people. As a matter of fact, Jermaine had been separated from his father and had recently found out who he was and where he was, and they had reunited as father and son. Cuban Joe and Al Sides had a history of bad blood between them. The defendant testified that he had been bullied, and others said that he had been bullied. Cuban Joe was a rather large man, and Al Sides is very small. From the record, it seemed that the defendant, my client, could provide alcohol, and there was an implication that he was able to manufacture his own moonshine. As this particular incident started that particular day, my client, Al Sides Larrañaga, came out of his trailer and started to walk his dog, and there's a confrontation with Cuban Joe, and a heated argument starts. Al Sides walks off with the dog and comes back a few minutes later, and the altercation starts. Another heated argument begins. There's a conflict among the witnesses as to who did what. At some point, Cuban Joe grabbed Al Sides. Al Sides pulled out his gun and began firing. And he fired more than once. He shot him in the chest, the face, and then when he was turned around on the ground, shot him in the back. There are three issues that we have raised in the direct brief. Texas Penal Code 931 says that deadly force can be used in defense of deadly force. That instruction was received and put into the jury charge. 932 of Texas Penal Code adds something extra. It gives a presumption that the force was necessary unless you're otherwise engaged in criminal activity. And the reason that this requested presumption was denied was because, technically, because Al Sides had a felony conviction, more than one felony conviction, that he was a felon in possession of a firearm, and that prevented him from getting the presumption. Our contention is that is not the kind of unlawful activity that is contemplated by the statute.
Do you have any authority that that exception doesn't apply in this case other than your argument that it's illogical? Do Do you have any authority?
Most of the law is against us. We have no law in our favor. Okay. We're just trying to say this is, there's one unpublished opinion out of Dallas, and we're saying that just cannot be the law.
Why not?
Well, I mean, if you're attacked by somebody with deadly force, are you not supposed to pull out your gun and defend yourself? Just
the gun you're not
supposed
to have.
Well, you're not supposed to have it, but if you're going to be able to get the self-defense, why wouldn't you get the presumption simply because you're a felon? And my understanding.
Well, a gun is not the only deadly force, and no. I understand that you shouldn't. A knife is perhaps ineffective against a gun if you were in a gunfight, but there are other forms of deadly force besides a gun. But he was prohibited from having a gun.
That is correct. Our argument is that the kind of unlawful activity that contemplates is maybe you're the aggressor in an ag assault deadly weapon and called it off, or maybe you're in a robbery or something of that nature. But just merely being in possession of it should not prohibit you from getting the presumption. But I will concede that the law is not in our favor in that regard, at least for what has been from opinions that have been issued so far. Issue two involves the issue of the gruesome photograph, whether or not its unduly prejudicial effect outweighs its probative effect. And here, it is a gruesome autopsy photograph, which the state admits they're always gruesome. That's the last photo of ourselves that we never want to have a jury look at. But in this particular context, it was different. This was not being introduced by the medical examiner. This photograph was sponsored by Jermaine Gill, the deceased son. And the interesting thing about it, if you look at the context, as soon as our objection that it was too gruesome was overruled, the next question by the prosecutor to Jermaine Gill is that how you want to remember your father? And that brought a very quick objection. And before the court could rule, the state withdrew its question. They knew, they calculated it. Should it have as an inflammatory, prejudicial effect as it possibly could? And the very fact that they asked the question, is this how you want to remember your father, shows that they were intentionally trying to inflame the minds of the jury.
But that photograph was later shown to the medical examiner, and he used it in his testimony, did he not?
He did.
And, in fact, that the photograph that you're objecting to, he actually still has the oxygen mask over his face, and there were other photographs that you're not objecting about on appeal that were arguably more gruesome than the one that you are complaining about.
Our point is that in this particular context, at that particular time, with that particular witness on the stand, it was intended to inflame the minds of the jury. And very seldom are these cases ever reversed because of gross pictures. The only one I know of that has ever been reversed was involved a capital murder case in which a dead fetus was placed upon the mother in the casket, and the court finally said that's going too far. For the most part, these photos are allowed, and at some point, we're hoping that the courts will say this is just not the way to do it, and especially sponsoring it with this particular witness. Issue three is regarding whether or not the detective is an expert in giving his opinion as to whether or not this was a case of self-defense. Years ago, the American Bar Association had a cover story entitled Dr. Cop, and it was about how often we allow policemen to testify as experts in criminal cases. Policemen, detectives seem to have a lower standard of being qualified as an expert than we do in a medical malpractice case or a products liability case. If this type of testimony were being introduced in a civil case, it probably wouldn't be allowed, at least without a very serious Daubert hearing. The thing is, it seems like because it's a criminal case where the expertise is supposed to be the same, there should be no difference whether somebody is an expert in a civil case or a criminal case, but we have this so-called soft science, And here we have an expert on the issue of self-defense. The state first says he's a lay witness. He is not a lay witness. He is a detective. How can he be a lay witness under 701 if he is a policeman? There was an objection to his expertise, and at that point, 702 in the case law says you're supposed to stop and have some kind of a hearing to say, is there a body of science? Have you studied this? Is there such a thing as the law of, or some expertise in regarding self-defense?
Did you ask for that kind of hearing?
All we have to do under the law is object to his expert status. At that point, it's incumbent upon the court to conduct the hearing.
Did you object to the court not conducting the hearing?
No, we did not, but I think our objection that he cannot testify as an expert immediately says that the court has to then conduct that hearing.
But why couldn't he testify as a lay witness? It's my understanding that there's a case out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, Ellison, where the court allowed, or the Court of Criminal Appeals allowed and recognized that a probation officer could testify as to the defendant's suitability for probation as an expert or as a lay witness.
Your Honor, I think once again, it's showing what I think is a, with all due respect, a cultural bias for law enforcement.
Was there any evidence that the police officer was familiar with this particular defendant or with these particular facts of this case that would give him personal knowledge that would qualify him as a lay witness?
Not that I can recall, Your Honor. I'm just saying that as the state said, he testified, he was a detective, had been a detective for a long time and handled these cases. I don't think he'd had any prior contact with this particular defendant. But it was interesting to note, and we did not raise it as an issue, but when one of the other witnesses there, who was the citizen witness, said in her opinion it was a case of self-defense, the state objected and they didn't let her testify about it. I mean, he's getting special status as a detective, as law enforcement, in order to testify as to his opinion that this was not a case of self-defense. One final note that I want to mention is that always we seem to butt against 44.2, the concept of harmful error. And it seems like if it's in favor of the defendant, it's never harmful error, or it rarely is. We have over a 95% affirmation rate of criminal cases after they're tried. I would just assert that they can't get it right 95% of the time. At some point, you have to be the gatekeepers and say, at some point, in order to ensure fair trials, we all want to have law enforcement, but sometimes the state goes too far and sometimes the courts bend over backwards too far to uphold convictions and to come down on the side of the state. At any rate, our argument is that on any one of these three issues, we're requesting reversal and remand or reversal and acquittal. Do you have any further questions?
I have one question. I've forgotten. In the transcript of the trial itself, when you objected to the detective, did you object based on qualification or did you object on reliability?
I specifically said I object to him being an expert. And I said, beyond that, it's speculation. That was the form of the objection.
Okay, so you didn't differentiate between his qualifications or the reliability of his opinion.
So he's not a qualified expert to give an opinion. That was the intent of the objection. I think it was specific enough that he has not been qualified to be an expert to give an opinion on self-defense.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you start, let me just say a word to our group that has traveled from Midland. If you all at any point need to leave and are unable to stay, please feel free to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stephen Condor on behalf of the state. This case involves a murder case of Joel Gill, who was gunned down in the street outside a party on Memorial Day weekend 2013. I think it's important, as Mr. Henderson pointed out, to kind of look at kind of the facts of this case. because they're really tied into the issues raised on direct appeal. And I think what's really critical is in this case there were two separate arguments. There was the first argument right outside the house, and then the appellant left the scene. He went off to sensibly walk with his dog. At that point, Mr. Gill and his son then proceeded to his truck to leave, but they stopped, unfortunately, to talk to a few people. At that point, the appellant comes back, and I think the testimony is pretty conflicted on this, but there's a lot of testimony that says there was no physical contact in this second argument, and until after the defendant shot Mr. Gill as he was headed toward his truck. And then, again, after he fell to the ground, he continued to shoot him, and he continued to threaten, and he even threatened Mr. Gill's son with the gun. So I think those kind of facts were before the jury in this case, and I think that that's important in this case. What's also interesting about this case is that, unlike a lot of cases, there were a significant number of witnesses to it. In many of these cases, we have a body, and we have the defendant, but we don't have a lot of witnesses. But here, as the court can see from the record, there are a number of witnesses who testified to what occurred outside this party. Getting to the defendant's first point of error, the reasonableness presumption instruction. Now, the Texas legislature in 931 and 932 has passed a series of laws regarding use of deadly force. This is a policy decision by our legislature, signed by our governor, that in these situations that we'd have for deadly force, and there would be a presumption of reasonableness, except when a defendant is engaged in criminal activity. The language of the statute is very clear. It doesn't provide any exception to this exception for situations where it's a felon in possession of a firearm. It simply is if you are involved in a criminal activity or criminal offense, you are not entitled to this reasonable presumption. As such, it was outside the purview of Judge Gallagher to be able to go and say, well, I don't think the law should say this, and I should make an exception when the statute doesn't provide for it. And here it was clear cut that the defendant was not entitled to possess the gun. He was currently serving parole, and under 4604A, if you are on parole, then you are not entitled to possess a gun. So, and he admits that that was criminal misconduct. As the court asked, I was only able to ascertain two unpublished cases out of the Dallas Court of Appeals where they took that same position that you're not entitled to a reasonable presumption if you're a felon in possession of a gun. But I found no case law which takes the contrary position, which allows a trial court to create an exception that the statute doesn't provide. I think because of that, the judge acted well within his discretion to deny the appellant the reasonableness presumption instruction. Moving on to the photograph in question, I think we need to keep in mind under Rule 403 that sometimes we casually refer to that rule as probative value versus prejudicial effect or unfair prejudice, but the actual language of the rule is that the probative value is substantially outweighed by unfair prejudice. And unfair prejudice isn't just simply that the evidence was prejudicial to the defendant, because if it didn't have some prejudice, the defendant wouldn't have any probative value whatsoever. It must suggest that the jury made its ultimate decision on an improper basis. And the photograph in question, I do not believe that it rises to that level. This photograph, I mean, there's no per se prescription against the admission of autopsy photos. They do limit it if there's significant mutilation caused by it. But in this case, they're really, if you look at the photo in question, it's not particularly unduly gruesome, and it's not particularly, doesn't show a lot of change. For the benefit of the audience, I think the picture, as I report on the brief, is it showed a cleaned up wound, it showed scratches, and it showed medical gear covering the mouth, keeping the head in place. But this is not one of these photos where we have organs or severe blood or all kinds of things that we might think of when we think of some sort of gruesome photo, something we might see from the end of an autopsy where they've completely cut away from the body.
Well, I think his real complaint is not the photograph, but how it was offered, and that it was offered to ask this unkind question to the son of the victim, and then the state withdrew the question immediately and made their point.
I think I'd take that on two parts. I think the fact that it was introduced as a son, I don't think that is differential, because I don't think there's I didn't see any case law which said that, you know, you could not introduce this photo through the son. I don't think that question necessarily was such that it automatically inflamed the jury. I mean, I think that this question was, it tied in with his prior testimony that this was his last memories of his father. And he had already testified to this matter because he was a witness to the shooting. So I don't think that that automatically, the way that that question was asked, I don't think it automatically serves to kind of inflame a jury so that it causes them to decide the issue on an improper basis. You know, do I think it's the best question or the best way we should have asked it? Probably not. And I think that upon hearing the objection, I think they were proper to withdraw that question. But I don't think that it, you know, that in itself would take this photograph and all of a sudden make it so inflammatory that the jury would have decided it rather than based upon the facts that they heard from the various witnesses who observed the shooting. Regarding the third issue, Detective Payne's question about did the defendant act, where he testified that in his opinion the defendant acted in self-defense. Now, I believe that the question was based upon Detective Payne's investigation of the case and his review of the injuries. So he's testifying about something that he's seen, and he's giving his opinion of it. And I think the law gives us a little bit of room for that for a police officer's testimony. In our brief, we cite a number of cases where police officers were able to give their opinion of the evidence or of the crime scene. And I don't think this case is any different. Plus, I think that it also is the fact that this is not a rookie police officer. This is not a brand new police. This is a police officer with significant experience in handling these kind of cases. And so I think that he also would qualify under either basis, that he could give an opinion as to whether he thought this amounted to self-defense. Do I think that if this was an improper question, it's albeit totally, that it's harmful? No. And I'll tell you several reasons. One, because the jury heard significant other evidence about what occurred at the shooting. And the other thing is, of course, the jury expects that the police officer believes that it's not, that it wasn't self-defense, because that's why he's there testifying. I think as compared to in a civil case as brought up by Mr. Henderson, a medical, these type of experts, we would expect them to be a little more detached from the situation because they're pure experts. Whereas a jury is going to understand that a police officer is going to have a certain amount of, if he's testifying for say, he's going to have a certain amount of like belief that this is self-defense, or he's not going to be, you know, this case is going to be handled differently. So I don't think that Detective Payne's testimony that it, the defendant acted in self-defense, had such a great effect that it caused the jury to make its decision based on an improper basis. Unless the court has any further questions, the state will rest and pray for an affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. Conder. Rebuttal, Mr. Henderson?
I guess if I have one philosophical question about what happened after this, is I hope somebody took care of the dog. I just wondered, you know, that was just sad to me. I would have to agree from the outset that the detective is certainly not a pure expert. He is a special kind of expert, and there should be no difference between an expert who is qualified to testify in a criminal trial just because he's a police officer and a doctor in a malpractice case or an engineer in a products liability case. And again, back to the context of the photograph. Certainly, they may not seem as gruesome to those of us that deal with it every day, but if someone hands the autopsy photo of their father in a courtroom in front of a jury, certainly that context has changed. That is not routine. That is not every day.
Aren't you really just complaining about the question that was asked and then withdrawn and not really about the photo because the photo was later used?
I'm complaining about both. I mean, once they've withdrawn the question, there's nothing to object to. We don't have a ruling. We have no way to preserve it. The only way we can confront and stop this kind of behavior is by complaining about the photograph, and the only way the state is going to be able to learn that they have to try their cases and not ask those kinds of questions is to get a reversal. At some point, these things we have got to say that they're harmful. The fallback argument seems to be all the time, well, there was plenty of other stuff. The guy was obviously guilty. So therefore, let's ignore the rest of it and let them get away with trying cases that way because there was so much other bad evidence in the case.
But don't you think the test really is not if they intended to inflame the jury, but in fact did inflame the jury?
Your Honor, they got a guilty verdict. I mean, other than having a motion for new trial and pulling them back in and asking them one by one, was that the thing that was really the linchpin? That would be very difficult to do as a practical matter. But it did happen in court, and I think they knew they had asked one question too many.
Well, Mr. Henderson, it's every time a question is withdrawn doesn't necessarily ascribe ill motive in asking it. Perhaps the prosecutor rethought the question, and so you're asking us to ascribe ill motive in the asking of a question when I don't see that anywhere in the record.
It's really hard. I mean, as we probably have all know, that 10% of communication or what happens in a courtroom is written out on the transcript. The other 90% is the inflection and what was happening in the courtroom, which is almost impossible to review. Thank you, Your Honors. We request remand or acquittal.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your arguments here today. We appreciate you coming to argue at Texas A&M University School of Law, and we appreciate your briefing and your arguments today were very helpful to us. So your case is submitted.